bcfmradio.com.
Citizen Carter calling Network 23. Network 23, are you receiving me?
This is Network 23, not receiving. Intermittent loss.
Edison Carter to Network 23. Come on, guys, clear this link.
Network 23 to Edison Carter. The link is strong and clear. 2 minutes to airtime. Your controller is Garister.
Thank you, 23.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We all rely on the National Health Service, but can we trust those in charge right now to leave it in a hale and hearty state for our elderly selves and future generations? Government leak this week reveals that Private Healthcare Secretary Jeremy Hunt has secretly doubled the number of NHS properties up for sale, just as the Naylor report suggested. Is Oliver Letwin's plan to destroy the NHS before the next general election well underway in secret? Plus, how well does a culture of denial and cover-up sit around the Bristol United Hospital's NHS Trust executive and board? Local man Alan Condon's baby son Benjamin was admitted to Bristol's Children's Hospital with a suspected cold, but caught a superbug in there. It took the Trust 18 months and legal threats before they admitted they'd misled Alan and the rest of his family on several counts that tiny Benjamin had been given a drug which he shouldn't have been before he sadly died. Well, we invited a former master of the Merchant Venturers and also so-called independent chairman of the Trust, which has responsibility for ethics, John Savage, as well as any other trustees or members of the executive board on this show. But we're told by Abby Evans at UHB headquarters at the end of Jamaica Street that none of the 25 or so running the Trust was available. So what happens when you're paying their wages but you can't necessarily trust the Trust? Plus, another look at 9/11 from another scholar. This week is the turn of Jim Mars. He's the author of a book, Rule by Secrecy, amongst many others, who sadly died this week in Fort Worth, Texas, in our run-up to this year's 16th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Our sister show Dialects back again on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This week, Mark Pope lives in Marshfield and his father Ray's series of 1970s children's books about the little people living on model railways. They've become collector's items. Also, sham democracy, dictatorship and media mind control on a massive scale. Well, is it true or not? We hear about the conspiracy scholar Jim Mars, who passed away this week, from someone that knew him. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or if you can't wait, download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But before all that, I'm joined by former GP Charlotte Patterson and former mental health nurse and health policy academic Sue Kilroe. Hi and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening.
Now, you're both part of this group, Protect Our NHS. You first, Charlotte. What's happening in the health service at the moment?
Well, the government's systematically destroying the health service at the moment. It's underfunding it very seriously, which I think most of us can begin to feel around us, as we can't get to GPs and we can't get our operations done. And it's also privatising it, which means it's breaking it up instead of being one good integrated service as it was designed to be. It's now little bits that are being sold off, as you said, buildings being sold off, but also contracted out services so that profit's being made out of it. Making profit out of people's illness is disgraceful.
But isn't that what pharmaceutical companies have been doing for years? They, in a way, there's a profit incentive on them. The more ill people, the more pills they need, the better. I mean, surely you must have come across that as a GP.
Well, just because they're doing it doesn't mean to say it's a good thing if the government starts doing it. It's bad whoever's doing it, trying to make money out of people's ill health. And we did have a system where taxpayers paid for their health service, and all the money they paid went into the health service. Now half of it drains out into profits and into people's shareholding.
So where is that money going if it's not going towards patient care?
Well, a lot of it is going into the private companies' profits and therefore to the shareholders. So if they take on a contract, a private company will usually bid for the contract and get it because they're going to provide it cheaper. The only way they can do that is A, to cut the service or cut the staff pay and conditions, which they nearly always do. And the second thing they do then is to make enough money to take some out for themselves. Otherwise it wouldn't be there. There wouldn't be any point in it.
Now, as a retired GP, I'm sure you're still in touch with many other GPs, or some other GPs anyway. How have they noticed changes to the way that the health service is being run and the priorities that they have over the last, I suppose we're talking about 7 years really, since the Health and Social Care Act in the 2010 government came in?
Well, I think for them, the fracturing of the health service gives them an awful lot of extra work.
What does that mean?
Well, before, if they wanted, say, someone had a bad hip and you wanted to get a specialist to see them, you simply chose the consultant you thought was best and referred the person to consultant. That doesn't happen anymore, so now you have to refer to a central referral system that will then decide where they're going to go. If they do get to see someone, they may or may not get the service that they thought they were going to get, and it's very, very slow, and the waiting lists are long. So all the time that the patient isn't getting what they want, they're constantly coming back to the GP. Understandably, it's the only place they can go. So the GP's work is increased as the health service becomes inefficient, more work the GP has to do, and there's a lot of extra paperwork, of course.
It must be a bit peculiar for you as a retired GP to be actually almost like diagnosing the National Health Service as if it's your patient.
I don't diagnose it as if my patient. I wouldn't give the government that pleasure. The government's just destroying it in front of my eyes, and as a GP, as a lot of other people, I can't sit by and see it disappear. It's our health service. We're the ones that have got to fight for it.
Is there anything we can do?
There's lots we can do. The main thing is to start to take responsibility for getting together with other people and defending things when they're not working well. Not by attacking the doctors and nurses who, generally speaking, are just trying to do a good job, but by putting pressure on the government, our MPs, and locally maybe just making a big fuss if something's about to go. There have been examples of some hospitals in Essex that were going to be downgraded, and there was a huge public outcry, and people really just, you know, took it upon themselves to do something. And in the end, those plans were changed because the MPs got involved and it was all changed.
Well, I can remember 5 or 6 years ago in Stroud, there was a maternity hospital on some very valuable land that the lots of house builders would very much like to build on, and the local people there saved it because effectively most everybody got involved. I mean, it's actually difficult to persuade people to take something out of their time to do this. But tell us about Protect Our NHS. What are you able to do in order to sort of bring people together? Are you able to actually focus effort a little bit?
Yeah, we're a group that meet every fortnight. We've quite a big group, and we've got all sorts of people, patients and previous health workers and health workers. And we do a lot of work out trying to involve other people. We do a lot of street stalls, for example. We go and talk when we get invitations. And then when there's a problem, for example, when Virgin Healthcare were trying to take over our community health services, we ran a big campaign that involved lots of people, and that was successful as well.
Just tell us about why you didn't want Virgin to do that. I mean, they're perfectly competent. Well, actually, some would say the trains don't always arrive on time. The flights don't always arrive on time. But, I mean, surely there's no reason why a company like Virgin couldn't do a job like that just as effectively as anybody else.
Well, they're a big private company, so the reason they're doing it is to make a profit. That's the first thing. It's they're not doing it for the good of the nation. They're not public servants. So they run it. They will run it in order to make a profit. They will downgrade staff's pay and conditions. They will downgrade the amount of service that is provided. And by doing that, they've got some money left in the bank, and pigs snout to get in the trough, and off the money goes.
Now, I'm also joined by Sue Kilroe. Sue, you're a former mental health nurse and also health policy academic, but almost the second part of your former job description that I find most fascinating, health policy. I mean, things aren't really going your way, I would imagine.
No, I feel that everything that I worked for all the way through my whole life, from when I enrolled as a student nurse in 1962 until now, has essentially been thrown in my face and undermined. At this point, it is truly heartbreaking and makes me, you know, either I'm going to sit down and cry and do nothing, or I'm going to fight. So I've chosen the fight route.
Is there anything we can do by fighting? Because ultimately, surely this is about money. I mean, there's lots of money going out of the National Health Service, as we've just heard, on other things like profits for private companies. One of the big ways that in which money is hemorrhaging out of the service is through the PFI deals and the interest payments on the PFI deals, for example. You get a wonderful, brand spanking new hospital. The only trouble is it's really not yours because it's owned by another company, a PFI deal company, and then they're using the fact that you need it to make a profit, a bit like a rack-renting landlord. So, I mean, you worked in mental health as well. It must actually affect you. You're talking about sitting down and crying. It's very difficult to know how to deal with something like this.
It's so big. It's very difficult to find a way in to create somewhere where you can get leverage to help people to understand that they are right and they should be angry and they can do something about it.
So what can we do?
We can, like Charlotte said, is that we have to come together and we have to work with journalists like you who are prepared to create a public discussion so that people know what's happening.
So do you think that there isn't a proper public discussion about what's going on? I mean, we've heard right at the top of the hour, I was talking about this report this week where it's actually been leaked that the government is actually selling off twice as many hospitals as they had told us that they were.
Okay. So that information is not new. Maybe the exact number of properties that will be sold off, but the direction of travel of the selling off assets been established for over a year. That's information.
So it's a principle, but what the headline's saying is it's quietly doubled just over the last few weeks, the number of NHS properties that it's selling off.
What would help us locally is if we could identify exactly which properties locally were on this list, and then people who live in the local area can develop a discussion about the value of that to them as health land, or the issue about housing and what sort of housing might happen in those space, and what the effect on the health service will be if the health service has got to sell off its property and then rent it back to use it to provide services.
Amazing.
Will be more PFI type tax.
Well, look at what's happened to Bristol General Hospital, of course. That has been sold off. It was actually, there was a load of wrangling for years about were they going to put any affordable housing in it. They finally said, no, we're not going to. And it's effectively been turned into luxury flats. Are we going to see the same with, King Edward VIII Hospital at the BRI, because that looks as if that may be being... I'm not sure what's happening with that.
Across the road from the opposite side of the road to the BRI. And there's the Nuffield Hospital in Clifton, and there's the hospital at the back of Barclay Square. That all of this was either, you know, it's been moved, not directly from NHS, but there's a lot of property around, and land is very expensive in Bristol, so we need people to come forward who know about property. One of the problems is if you get a group of retired, you know, a protest group that is very largely comprised of health and social care workers, we need people who have property and legal knowledge to work with us to be able to help with this campaign.
I think the other thing to say is that we don't need to be selling off and making more money. The government's got lots of money. We're the richest one, about the fifth richest country in the world. It's a question of where we put the money. And, you know, most countries in Europe spend much more on their health than we do. And the government simply needs to get out there and start spending again, as they have done. The last Labour government spent much more money than the
government. Well, what we hear constantly from Jeremy Hunt is that they're spending more and more on the health service all the time.
Well, of course they're spending more, because they've set up a structure that's very, very expensive to run. It's absolutely loaded with chief executives, and they are all on super high salaries. The numbers of people who earn over £150,000 a year has rocketed in the NHS. And that's, that it doesn't go into frontline services. These are people who are managing the business process. They're not producing health.
Well, that's amazing, because it almost parallels with the BBC. I can remember working there and feeling that if only we could get rid of all of these managers and all of the middle managers and all of the producers that have been taken off working on programmes because their programmes were so low rated, that actually we could just get on and make programmes. It would be a hell of a lot easier. The only people we really did want to keep were the engineers that actually kept the studios going. So it's a similar kind of thing, it seems, going on there. But I just want to reiterate that I did ask for the United Hospital Bristol's NHS Trust to come on this programme. So one of the 25 or so people running it, that's both on the executive board and on the actual trustees themselves, to come and talk about what's happening, to give us a balanced view. But it just seems to me pretty strange, Sue, that out of 25 of them being given a fair bit of notice to come on the radio, not one single one of them wants to come.
Well, there's a culture of silence imposed on health workers right through the NHS.
Well, hang on, because that's hopeless when it comes to safety, isn't it? If you're not allowed to talk about things, you can't actually talk about safety issues.
Well, we know that NHS England has done everything it can possibly do to deny junior doctors or doctors as a whole the right to be whistleblowers, and is fighting a hugely expensive case over a guy called Dr. Day. But that's at the formal end of the suppression of dialogue within. But on a day-to-day basis, you will find that NHS staff are very reluctant to engage with any member of the public about what's happening to the NHS. And that's because there's pressure on them. Subtle bullying, all sorts of different ways in which, and they're frankly sometimes told, do not discuss politics.
Well, I mean, surely everybody has a right to, freedom of speech. What will happen to NHS employees if they do speak out?
Well, they can be blacklisted, and life can be made very difficult for people who step out of line within big institutions like the NHS, and that does happen to people. So if some people won't do it, then others won't. So the culture and then they end up, because they feel uncomfortable to talk to each other even about what's happening, they end up really as a workforce that doesn't know that much about what's happening.
Now, Charlotte, it doesn't sound like a very good culture, a culture of fear, to be the predominant culture in a hospital.
No, it's disgraceful, but it expands, as Sue said, it's not just in one hospital, it's going right through the system. And it's particularly important in the fact that we don't hear as the public what the plans are for our health service locally. We know, people who are in the know that the local NHS has got to save, in inverted commas, i.e. cut £200 million, £300 million, I think, out of the budget. But most people don't know that. Most people don't know what the plans are and how it's planned to do. There's secrecy in day-to-day stuff, but also secrecy in these huge plans that are going to affect it. There's no consultation at the moment about them. There's no democracy at all.
Well, I'm also joined by, who's been sitting here very patiently, local man Alan Condon, whose son sadly died in the Bristol Children's Hospital. Hi, Alan, welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
Could you just give us an idea and take us through what happened in your case?
Ben developed a cold at home when he was 8 weeks old, and he was taken into hospital and it was said he had human metapneumovirus, which is very much like RSV.
Sorry, what's RSV?
So it's like it's just like a cold virus, which is very, very common with youngsters, especially under 5 years old, at a certain time of the year. So he was taken into Bristol Children's Hospital with this, and during that week, we were informed that, you know, he was getting worse, and they suspected this secondary bacterial infection that they would treat with antibiotics. And at the time, it went on and on
so
and
did
on.
Did he actually get some sort of secondary infection in the hospital?
Yeah, he got something called Pseudomonas, which he caught in the hospital, but because it went untreated, it eventually ended up as sepsis. So he died of Pseudomonas sepsis, or sepsis syndrome from the Pseudomonas, because it was left untreated.
I think the most shocking thing, in a way, in your case, aside from your son dying, was just how difficult it was to find out what had actually happened.
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing for us as well was that the hospital knew that Ben had developed a secondary infection several hours before he died, and they failed to tell us, they failed to put it in any medical note, and also they convinced us that a post-mortem wasn't necessary, and then in a meeting 7 weeks after Ben had died was the first time that they told us that he developed this secondary infection. However, then they told us that it could have only been on the last day, because they'd done blood tests that were negative the day before, and we later found out that them tests were never taken, so there was never, you know, there was the negative. Them saying there was a test done was a lie, but also that the fact that there was a negative result, and it took us 12 months to find out that actually they knew about it prior to Ben dying. They made this claim that they only discovered the infection after he died.
So how did you feel you were treated as a family?
The first thing is you, when your child dies, you don't know what the process is. You just sort of go along, you know, you sort of put into a channel.
If there's any doubt whatsoever, surely, you know, there should be some kind of an inquest.
Well, we had an inquest 18 months later, and, you know, over that, during that 18 months, the hospital finally, you know, they tripped themselves up on several occasions, and we discovered that he had that, you know, they admitted to us that not only did he have this infection, but had they treated it earlier, then it would have given him a much better chance of treating him.
That's a terribly long time to wait for an inquest, isn't it? I mean, that's 18 months, I suppose, you're having to wait and, to a certain extent, fight to get that inquest.
It is, and also as well, it's during that period of time, they kept tripping themselves up and up. But the biggest thing for us was when we finally got to the inquest, and we thought that, you know, that would be where the truth eventually came out properly. They then backtracked on everything that they'd said, and told a different story at the inquest, and convinced the coroner that he didn't have an infection. The infection didn't cause him to die, and that had they treated it, it would have made no difference.
And what do you think of that?
The whole thing's absolutely shambolic. I mean, from start to finish, I mean, from 5-6 hours before Ben died, we believed that they were well and truly aware that he was going to die, and that they done everything they possibly could to cover his death up.
The specific individuals that are involved here, it would have been nice to at least make some of these general, I mean, we're not so interested in that, but some of these general points. If the chairman of the trust, who's in charge of ethics, John Savage, was sitting around this table as we asked him to be, and he decided that he couldn't make it, or none of his colleagues could make it, what would you say to him?
I think the thing is that we've never had the answers to the basic questions. The trust are very, very good at providing, you know, overarching documents, 40-page documents, and then posting on there the trust to say that, you know, they've done everything they can to answer questions. However, that they don't have the ability to not answer. You know, they have the ability to avoid the very simple questions, and you know, the ones about the lies at the inquest or the lies in the meetings, and they just railroad you down a certain track, you know, where they claim that they've done everything they can to help you, when actually all they're doing is just covering their own backs.
Why have they done that, do you think?
I believe that they became aware that they'd made a mistake with Ben before he died. They were very complacent about the illness he had. I mean, they told us 3 days before he died that Ben is of no concern to us. We have children on the ward who are seriously ill and can die, which pretty much summed up the treatment and the care they give to Ben compared to the other children on the ward. And I think that on the last day, they then realised that he'd severely deteriorated and that they'd got it wrong. And they just wasn't willing to accept them failings. And then once the lies started, I think it just created this huge snowball effect.
Well, it's easy to, in hindsight, but do you now wish you'd never taken Ben to hospital or even to a doctor or anything?
I think ultimately you've got to have faith. You've got to have faith in the NHS. You know, whether you go to your GP, to the hospital, to you know, I think if we say we're not going to take them, you know, then as a parent, then we're putting our children at risk. You know, we've got to have the faith that. But you know, we've made a conscious decision now that we certainly wouldn't go back to Bristol Children's Hospital.
Now, I came across you actually walking up and down the pavement outside the BRI. I don't imagine that you're allowed to distribute the leaflet that you were inside the BRI, in the coffee shop or whatever, which would be an interesting place to try and do it. You've got your leaflet, it says NHS Child Death Cover-Up, Bristol Children's Hospital, and there's a picture of your son here. I mean, you have obviously decided that you haven't really had any kind of justice through the processes you've already been through.
We've decided that we've had enough of their processes. So, you know, they're railroading, and, you know, they put you into a little spiral and spin you around until you drop out the bottom and go away. So we've decided...
Just tell me about those processes. What processes are they?
Well, they'll never answer the question. You know, they'll always say, we'll come back to you. You know, you go to a meeting and they'll have 30, 40 days following that meeting to create the answers. The child death review, you know, they provide you a report, and if you challenge it, you know, there's another 2 months following that. And it just got to the point where we realised that the one key point for us was there was a clear inconsistency between what a doctor had told us in a meeting and what was said at the inquest. And they got a professor to investigate it, and the professor's answer was that there was no inconsistency. And it was clear to everyone to see that there was. And for us, that was the real key turning point for us to realise that actually they wasn't interested in helping us. What they were doing was they were interested in making sure that they came out looking good.
It does sound like they may have been just employing somebody to tell them what they wanted to hear and paying them public money too.
Well, I think one of the things which stands out for us is that they're very, very good with the media side of things, and very good at making themselves sound very, very good in the process. You know, they offer a small apology for something that's not significant or not relevant, but will avoid all the relevant, you know, the relevant matters within the case.
So what have they done with you now? Because you're distributing these leaflets, as you should be, have every right to, I suppose, outside the hospital, taking your time out. Was it once a week or how often?
I do 2 hours. 2 hours every day through the week, and I stand out. You know, I stand at the high footfall area by the hospital, by the trust and the main entrance, and I've given them out. And you know, I'm getting lots of feedback from staff who work at the hospital that there's a lot of outrage from staff in the hospital that nothing's getting done about this, and that this person's standing there every day handing out these leaflets. Some of the staff are taking it quite personally, but ultimately the names and faces of the people that are in there, and they've done wrong, and they've covered up a child's death, and somebody needs to be held accountable for it.
So are they pursuing you or whatever in some way? I don't imagine that they particularly want you standing out there distributing information about what happened to your son.
No, they don't. But every single word that's in there is factual information. There is a couple of the individuals who've took the opportunity to pursue me legally. But the trust in general are very much staying away from the matter and allowing it to happen. But I'm not so sure that there's anything that they can do to stop me.
It doesn't sound like going back to our retired health professionals from Protect Our NHS doesn't sound...
It rings bells.
Does it?
This the sort of dilemmas that we're facing all of the time is there's a lot of concern growing in the Bristol area about the services, infertility services. At Southmead Hospital, we had one of the best functioning fertility services units in the country with very, very good results. And the Southmead Hospital Trust undertook to build them as their own special building, and it's got laboratories and all of the freezer equipment and everything in that's needed. But because of the NHS cuts, one way or another, the service is being withdrawn from the NHS. It's no longer going to be provided there. And there's a decision was made that the demand for the service was falling, and therefore that there was no further need for that contract to be fulfilled. And we've been trying to find the information, the evidence that that decision was based on, and we can't get anyone to come forward and show us where the evidence is, how they analysed, who criticised and did the analysis of what figures that allowed them to make this decision to withdraw this service. There will be an infertility service, but maybe people will have to go to somewhere like Birmingham. And ultimately, the space that's created by the withdrawal of the NHS unit is to be filled by private, for-profit fertility service companies. And one of those companies is to be headed up by the consultant that had previously run the NHS.
That seems to have happened quite a lot, doesn't it, with former people involved in professional roles. So it's happened a lot in social work as well,
yes.
Where they've set up their own businesses and they're now...
Is this a conflict of interest or not?
Well, it is, obviously. Anyway, Charlotte, I wonder if that story Alan's just told us rings any bells with you. I feel a bit guilty in a way. I mean, we're almost like a kind of court of appeal here, where one side has not bothered to turn up in court, you know, because surely what Alan's saying here is, and in a way explaining to all of us, is that the systems of checks and balances within the NHS right now just don't seem to be working.
Well, I think it's a heartbreaking story, obviously, but yeah. I think it's also an example of what happens when you lose democracy in something like our National Health Service. It was set up to have a lot of local democracy with the community health councils and so on. And once we start to lose that and trusts then become more like big business, then we start to lose this human side and this democracy side and this ethical side, and then we end up with this. That's not just words, is it? Then we end up with the story that we've just heard. So I think it shows when we use these big words like democracy and so on, what we're really meaning is that people like Alan end up with this story, and how can someone try and get over that? So, yeah.
What were the community health councils? I mean, these were some sort of way in which that people could make kind of formal complaints about the National Health Service in the old days, were they?
They were very much part of the structure of the NHS when it was set up. And they were a way of the community being connected to their local hospitals and
providers,
GPs,
yeah.
Because it wasn't then split up in the way it is now, you know, between providers and whatever all the words they have. It was just a locality where you had, you know, health service workers trying to provide a service for the community that they were in. That's what it was, our health service. And the community council was the link between the community they were in and the people trying to provide the service.
But I mean, surely, you know, with those, still you're going to find doctors, consultants, even GPs, etc., I suppose, trying to cover up if they've done something wrong. No one, you know, it's a natural thing in human beings that we don't want to necessarily admit we've done something wrong, do we?
Well, it's part of professional ethics that you don't do that. But, of course, there will always be people who do. The thing is that we have to have good structures in place that are ethical and democratic so that people who've got concerns can have them properly heard.
If you don't have some sort of mechanism for sitting down and looking at what happens in an untoward episode, then you don't learn and how to stop it happening again. So that it, you know, the silencing and covering things up just contributes to a downward spiral of the quality of the service as a whole.
I mean, all you really learn is how to cover it up better the next time.
Yeah.
Which is rather worrying. The other thing is, you know, it would have been lovely to have John Savage here, who, of course, was actually up until a few years ago a member of the Labour Party, but he dropped out when Jeremy Corbyn took over. But he calls himself an independent chair of the UHB NHS Trust, but of course for anyone that looks into his background, you'll find that he was in charge of Business West, which is of course a bit of a very powerful networking group which is very good at getting large amounts of taxpayers' money for big business in the region, and also a former master of the Merchant Venturers. You know, these are the people who were involved in financing John Cabot's discovery of America, even though of course quite a few 100 million or so Native Americans had already discovered it, and also of course in the slave trade. But great pity that John can't be here. What do you make of this sort of the reluctance to actually come on and discuss these things? You first, Sue.
Okay. Well, the NHS is like society as a whole, and there is a sort of group of people in the city that you would call the establishment. And both North Bristol Trust and UBT is managed and run by people who are members of the establishment. So that's big. There's very strong connection between big business and the public services. And we have this at a local level, an example of which of something that's called the revolving door syndrome, where that people move from business into public services and back into business again. And you know, Simon Stevens, who's the head of NHS England, is the most high-profile and threatening person to the NHS, who has revolved from the NHS to business in the head of the biggest health insurance business in America, and back to the UK to actually be the civil servant in charge of the NHS. So that we have local versions. So I think that Savage is very much like that at a local level. The mystery really is how he was ever a member of the Labour Party.
Well, I mean, it just seems interesting.
Rather than the fact he isn't anymore.
How do people like this, who seem to be so very close to big business, get put into positions like that? Because they're spending £500 million, roughly, that's the budget of UHB Trust, of our money every year on what's supposed to be a public service. Mm. But they seem to be actually maybe closer to big business than they are to public service.
Well, I'm very happy, you know, through my life for all of that money to be spent on health services, whose primary purpose is to create health in the population, to address the health needs and to meet those needs, and to have as their primary aim the creation of health and well-being. But because business interests are sanctioned by the government as the primary purpose of our health services now, that the and the loading of all of the bodies that manage our health services with business expertise, business people, primary purpose is profit. It's so that the subcontracting of services out of the public service for the NHS to companies is a very comfortable process for people who are from the business community. And they believe that they can do it better than anybody else. They can't. You know, the evidence, universal evidence is that publicly owned health services are more effective, more efficient, and the people who live in those countries there's a sort of greater degree of equality between the rich and the poor, and there's better health.
Sounds to me like this is a culture which is coming from the top down, John Savage, so get your finger out, come on this programme and face some of your critics rather than running and hiding away. Just before we finish, I'd just like to ask all of you how you think things could be improved, because we know, I think, that it's not working. We know that there is effectively a massive sabotage of our future health going on around the country, not just here in Bristol. But with you, Charlotte, we can't get appointments with our GPs at the moment. So what can we do? Is anything... You know, in fact, it's quite difficult. You can get appointments with your GPs, but it's getting more and more and more difficult. What can we do to sort it out?
Well, on the bigger scale, there is a plan that is well thought through and would take our health service back much more to how it was originally, and that's called the NHS Bill. There's a bill that's been trying to get before Parliament, and that contains a lot of detail, but it's basically getting rid of this marketisation, getting rid of the private companies and making it a proper public service again. So one thing we can all do is to promote the NHS Bill, and we can find that on the internet quite easily and talk to our MPs and so on. The other more local thing is that there's going to be a big march in Bristol on July the 9th, which is against which is against particularly the council cuts, which of course affect health hugely through social care, but it'll be against cuts generally, and that's a place one can get out on the street and just make our feelings felt. So keep September the 9th in your diary.
And don't underestimate the fun of actually getting out on the street with other people who feel the same, because you just get a sense that this isn't just about something that you read in the newspaper. This is actually about a mass movement that's decided that they're not going to do this to our National Health Service, probably the most amazing thing that Britain has ever produced. Anyway, what about you, Sue, on how to fix it?
Yes, well, we absolutely have to pull the NHS back from the profit motive. I think we've got to do everything that makes that possible. And we need everybody, you know, that small groups protesting, and even if they're doing really good work at all sorts of levels, it will never have the same effect as a mass movement.
Well, Protect Our NHS is a good place to start. Where do we find you? Either physically in a room or on the internet. I'll put a link up on our show page as well.
We can provide you with that information, but we meet on the first and third Tuesday of every month. And currently we're using a room in Tony Benn House to do that. We have all sorts of subgroups that work on different issues. And we need loads of people.
Well, I'll just make sure the contact details are on the show page at thisweek.org.uk.
We have a very active Facebook page where we'd love people to be able to, you know, comment on what we put there and put in their own experiences on there, and that tells people what's going on, as well as a website.
We need people to share their stories about what's happening to them, like
your family story.
Like
it's
Alan,
really important that these stories are shared.
Alan, nothing's going to bring your son back, but I really admire what you're doing, because I think you said to me when we were, this isn't about me, this is about making sure this doesn't happen to other people in the future. It's a wonderful sentiment. Thank you so much. So how do we fix it?
I think there's two things, really. For the first one is honesty with families in this situation. You've got to remember we're talking about a child's life. We're not talking about, you know, it's not just a product or something. You know, this is someone's life, and actually what they're doing is they're destroying families. You know, they're destroying our family, they're destroying other families with what they're doing. One of the things that we're now in the process of doing along with the leaflets is we've set up a petition to challenge Jeremy Hunt on the law around what these consultants and senior managers actually from Bristol Hospital have been allowed to get away with. So we've set that up online, and we've had a great response from it. Within the first couple of weeks, we got just coming up to 2,000 signatures, which we have a long way to go. But I genuinely believe that people supporting something like that is going to put more and more pressure on. We're not alone in the issue with Bristol Hospital. You know, there's several families which I'm aware of that are going through the same processes from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, but I think ultimately they just need to start being honest with people and looking at the mistakes, because they're never going to learn from the mistakes if they don't accept them, and they're never going to move on from them and be better in future.
Well, one thing you need to do, John Savage, is make sure you don't bully and sack your employees if they speak out and if they say what they feel to some of the patients. So thank you very much. That was a retired GP, Charlotte Patterson, and also retired mental health nurse and health policy academic, Sue Kilroe, and also Alan Condon, who can be found on the email of Benjamin Condon, CONDON, at outlook.com. Thanks very much, all of you, for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're going to have a listen now to a bit of Donald Trump, I'm afraid, because he has been speaking out about North Korea. And we're going to go, I think this is an NBC report about what he's been saying about North Korea.
The alarming warning tonight from a U.S. official briefed on the Defense Intelligence Agency assessment, telling NBC News Kim Jong-un has now constructed a miniature nuclear warhead small enough to fit inside one of its new long-range missiles, a missile that could reach the U.S. mainland. A major line crossed. The dictator has before shown off what he claims to be a miniaturized nuclear weapon. Now he may have built one.
The problem is he's beginning to perfect all of the elements of the ability to deliver a nuclear device to the homeland.
The speed of the regime's nuclear progress is stunning. U.S. intelligence thought it would take years to get this far. But just 11 days ago, North Korea launched a missile test that could reach all the way to Chicago.
The underestimation of the pace of this program, it represents a real blind spot as well as a danger for the United States.
There are still big hurdles for North Korea, crafting a warhead that can survive re-entry into the atmosphere and testing its accuracy to hit a target.
Ignition.
While this is just one intelligence assessment, the fear is North Korea is on track to solve the technical challenges sooner rather than later.
The North Koreans, if they proceed on their nuclear program, will figure out how to miniaturize the nuclear device, which they have shown that they know how to detonate, miniaturize it and put it on top of an ICBM.
Now, that was really notable, Martin, for that report, for starting off by saying on NBC the North Koreans have miniaturized their nuclear weapons, blah, 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 big announcement. And then by the end of the report, they're saying, well, they might be doing it sometime in the future.
Yes, I mean, there's an awful lot of disinformation and hysteria going on. I mean, it's pretty clear that the North Koreans have developed viable nuclear weapons, although whether they've developed ballistic missiles that can deliver them to the US is debatable. They can probably deliver them to Japan, which is much nearer, and Japan, of course, is the traditional enemy of Korea. They were the occupying power in Korea from 1905
okay, so
to 1945.
Let's just have a listen now to what Donald Trump actually said.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
Well, fascinating comments from Trump, but even more fascinating is what the people who live on Guam, 100,000 of them, think about all this, which we've heard hardly anything of. Well done, BBC, for yesterday getting a Chimaros doctor, he's Michael Bavanka, from the University of Guam on to talk about what they make of this latest saber-rattling.
For the past few years, there has been regular threats made by North Korea as they've been testing their missiles. Frequently, they'll mention that they can target Guam, that they could hit Guam. This was sort of the most specific and pronounced threat to the island. But what really sort of pushed it to a new level of anxiety here was Donald Trump's response. Is his aggressive rhetoric. Usually we get that just from the North Korean side, and the U.S. response is much more measured. And so that's really what made things a little bit more anxiety-ridden today, was just the fact that on both sides of us, we had these people using very aggressive language, pointing weapons at each other. And the people of Guam, we just could not help but feel kind of caught in the middle of this war of words, which could easily become a war involving real weapons. Guam is a beautiful island. It's only about 212 square miles. Imagine that one-third of that is U.S. military facilities with bombers and fighters landing all the time, miles and miles of military fencing, aircraft carriers and nuclear submarines visiting regularly. And so Guam lives a very militarized existence, which is why these sorts of threats are common. Just last year, the Chinese government announced that they had developed a missile which they named in honor of Guam. It was called the Guam Killer, because now they said that they could reliably target Guam with their missiles. And so this is the kind of reality for us. The United States itself has called us the tip of their spear.
The tip of their spear. This is not the most helpful language, but Martin, this is seems as if this is another potential conflict zone. We were talking about the start of World War III, another little plank that's spinning. But the main problem with Korea is that it doesn't seem like the American government, or certainly Donald Trump, cares any more about a North Korean life than he does about a South Korean life.
Well, I mean, the rhetoric is way, way out of line. I mean, Trump's put himself in an impossible position where he's basically threatened to nuke North Korea or to carry out an attack on them, which is exactly will lead to the nuclear war that everybody claims they don't want. And the fact of the matter is, if a state has nuclear weapons, just as Pakistan developed nuclear weapons in the 1990s, the Israelis developed them in the 1980s and 1970s, neither of them were supposed to have them. But once they've got them, then there's not a lot you can do.
Finally, a bit of I hadn't heard this on the mainstream news at all. This is from the Donetsk People's Republic's news service. Great look. I'll put a link to that on our show page. The United States has urged its citizens to leave North Korea before the 1st of September.
Well, that's because they're potentially planning. McMaster has said we could go to war, we could have a preemptive war on North Korea. Although somebody else pointed out, you can't preempt something that's already happened. You can't have a preemptive war to stop nuclear weapons being developed by the North Koreans. They've already got them. And at that point, you just have to back off. You can't force them to give up nuclear weapons. From their point of view, it's absolutely logical. It's the reason that Britain claims to have nuclear weapons. We're not going to use them. We're just going to use them if someone uses them on us.
We haven't got time for Jim Mars, unfortunately. Maybe we can do that next week, but we can hear something from him anyway about him on Tuesday's dialect. But there is the potential, of course, you know, everyone, really, many people out there talking about the 9/11 attacks as a false flag with some kind of inside job, maybe even a nuclear false flag in North Korea.
Well, something like that may happen. The North Koreans are easy patsies for this, because if for example, a ship is sunk, and they say, oh, the North Koreans have sunk the ship, like the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which began the Vietnam War, because North Korea has got such bad credibility, it's the sort of thing that people might believe, and then they say, all right, this is justification to have a war with them. But the fact,
if you wanted a war with North Korea, would you sanction a false flag nuclear attack?
Well, you might if you were the sort of person that wants a war with North Korea. The problem is,
nobody wants a war like this, do they?
Well, you just don't know, do you? The problem with this, I don't think anybody wants a war on the North Korean side, the South Korean side, and let's not forget that they've got some views about all of this. And of course, they've had military dictatorships in South Korea. They haven't got one at the minute, but in the past they have. Brutal military dictatorships. And the idea that North Korea are the bad guys and South Korea are the good guys, so, to some extent true, but to some extent not true.
So it's okay, nobody really wants a war, do they?
Nobody really wants the First World War, but one shot by Gavril Princip led to a war, and especially when you've got people shouting their mouths off like Trump and the North Korean
and
leadership,
of course,
the possibility of a war is definitely
there.
You've
also got people making money out of war, folks. So Putin has stayed well out of the fray, braving the cold waters as he strips down to the waist in Siberia on a fishing holiday. Apparently now he's nipped down to Abkhazia as well, looking at the Black Sea. But the US is building a base in the Black Sea, a new base in Ukraine.
Yes, that's right. I mean, what's interesting this week is that the Chinese and the Russians have supported a sanctions policy in the UN Security Council. It's about time that the Americans started cooperating with others instead of just acting unilaterally.
Amen to that. Okay, so time to sign off for the news, Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Bakawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Brislington West, Harriet Bradley. Also to retired GP, Charlotte Patterson, and former mental health nurse, health policy academic, Sue Kilrow from Protect Our NHS, as well as Alan Condon. I'll put links to Alan's campaign as well on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialect remembers the life of Texas conspiracy scholar Jim Mars next Tuesday at noon. Catch it online now if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. This show's story links and comment page is thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1996, Shaft Benjamin and Amanda Shaw. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Jaja is putting on the pressure now. Jaja is putting on the pressure now. Lord, I'm a lion of Judah.
on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.